This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
If you can provide the social experience that I mentioned earlier and make it a really rich and engaging experience, why cinemas now need to bring more to their experience than just the film. What gamers do dig is relevant connections between their gaming experience and the products to be sold.
Welcome to the Paper Planes Marketing Podcast, episode number 880. Welcome to my show, our show. Not that Matt's ever in this, but, you know, let's just call it our show, just so he doesn't feel left out. So my business partner, Matt, we've done 80 episodes, which, you know, that's quite an achievement. I'm really quite proud of that. We've interviewed some fantastic people over the years and really enjoyed every single podcast I've done. That's probably actually a lie. There's about three or four that I thought were terrible, but who those ones are I will take to my grave. If you think you know, by all means, email me. If you think you know which of my worst podcasts, and please don't email me and say all 80 because I'll just delete you. But if you think you know which my worst podcasts are, then email. I'll give you $10 if you guess one of them. Oh dear, I've opened a can of worms there. Anyway, for podcast number 80, this is probably my biggest fanboy moment. I mean, I got a little bit fanboy when we had Glenn on from the from Shark Tank, Glenn Richards. Sorry, I forgot his surname there for a moment. From Shark Tank. That was kind of a little bit fanboy because he's quite famous. We've had a couple of other famous people on. But yeah, Glenn was someone that I was looking forward to and excited to interview for a long time. But this one is probably really kind of nerdy fanboy. It's John Satterley. John Satterley is the CEO and co-founder of an organization called Fortress Australia, Fortress Esports. He is building a esports venue, a 7-day-a-week venue that are cathedrals to the gaming culture, not just video games, but all the other good stuff related and connected, cosplay, RPGs, tabletop gaming, drones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you're a gaming man, and my God, John, even though he's in his late 40s, he's played a lot of games, a lot of arcade games, a lot of computer, desktop, a lot of console games. He knows a lot about games. And honestly, Fortress, I'd go and live down there. If that didn't upset my wife and two kids, I'd move into Fortress Esports. But yeah, look, this is a podcast where we talk about marketing and advertising and its relation to esports, which is the focus that we wanted to look at today. But honestly, we get sidetracked and talked about all sorts of other things as well. So, you know, it is what it is. If you're a gaming fan, it's important that you listen to this one. If you're gaming and marketing, if you are in gaming and you're a player, it's important to listen to this one as well, because, you know, some really astute observations from John. But I think probably the standout that we'll talk about in this is about the target demographics and about the sort of people that are gaming at the moment that could easily be your customers and your target demographic, and potentially about how to reach them. So yeah, so look, big fanboy episode this, very excited by it. So much so, I'm just going to flick through the normal housekeeping stuff, rate and review us, talk to Gilberto, come and find us on flypaperplanes.co and add me on LinkedIn. Yeah, there's not much else to that. Let's just jump straight into Paper Planes Marketing Podcast number 80 with John Satterley. Welcome to the Paper Planes Podcast, John Satterley. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Yes.
Now, you're down in Melbourne today. How's Melbourne treating you?
Well, I'm sort of a Melbourne born and raised, so I think it just treats me like
like it treats everybody
in a pot, basically. I just absorb Melbourne as part of my everyday life. So, but the weather recently has been predictably grim.
And, yes, that's Melbourne. Yes, yeah. That's why I live in Queensland, because it's predictably ridiculously hot all the time.
That's right.
Now, let's just, for all the people out there that don't know who you are, I've done a little bit of an introduction, but let's find out and explain exactly who you are and where you're, what you're working on at the moment.
No, I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called Fortress Esports, or we also refer to ourselves as Fortress Australia, and we are in the process of building a huge video game and esports entertainment centre in the heart of Melbourne CBD at the Emporium Shopping Centre.
So this is the main reason I got you on today, because I am a sad overage fanboy for this kind of stuff. So
I don't think there's such a thing as overage fanboy.
No, there isn't.
Like, if you do the research, the average age of a gamer is in their sort of mid-30s.
Right, okay. Well, that was one of my questions. So we'll sort of go straight to that, because I'm really interested to understand that demographic. So you're saying it's sort of mid 30s. What else is there? What other kind of demographics that sort of, you know, make these people stand out?
Yeah, well, I actually start to think that from all of our research and just looking around, is that gaming and the mainstream are sort of one and the same. And I think the idea that gamers are a fringe or a niche, increasingly when you peek under the surface, you realize that that's actually not at all the right way to think about it. And one way that, or one thing that highlights that reality is just look at franchises like Call of Duty.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can do $600 million in a weekend of sale.
Yeah.
And then compare that to sort of Hollywood or whatever, and you go, well, video games actually is way, way, way bigger. And so you then go, well, how come everybody's talking about the latest, you know, movie or Marvel franchise movie around, the mythical water cooler or whatever, but they're not talking about, you know, scenes from Red Dead Redemption 2 or whatever it might be. Well, that's just perhaps perception, because the gatekeepers of media, of mainstream media, that, you know, that people are, that boomers and others think about, aren't referring to those games, but young people certainly are. But that doesn't mean that older people aren't playing games as much as young people either. So it's the demographics are stretched from, you know, little kids to 10-year-olds playing Minecraft right through to, well, I'm 48, and I haven't stopped playing games since I was 10 a long time ago. So there's no I think, easy go-to demo. It's pretty much a cross-section of society.
And how do you find the male-female split as well? Is that something that's perhaps changed a lot in the last few years?
I wouldn't say that. In the privacy of people's game playing homes and where they play, and whether, you know, I think, and the research shows that it's around 50, you know, it's what you'd expect, 50-50 women and men playing games.
Yep.
I think what happens is in the public profile of a gamer, in especially also in esports and sort of elite professional game playing, remember, that's just a subset or a fringe of overarching games culture.
Yeah.
Males dominate. And so you get a skewed opinion of whether gaming is a male pursuit or not. And I think, in fact, what's going on in the privacy of people's lives is that women and men are playing games equally.
I'm going to digress completely on a conversation that I had at a barbecue 2 weeks ago with a group of friends and some guys that I know. I mean, I'm 45. They're in their, you know, mid to late 30s. Mm-hmm. And everyone's sitting around having a, you know, talking to barbecue. There's a guy there that I play a lot of mobile games with. So Clash Royale, used to play Clash of Clans with him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I was telling him about Call of Duty Mobile. So you would obviously know Call of Duty Mobile.
Sure.
You know, been a massive, from what I understand, been a massive success for Activision. And Tencent. And there was a girl sitting around the table. She was the wife of another one of our friends, and she's perked up when I mentioned Call of Duty Mobile, and just, you know, like a meerkat, you know, bobbing up in the middle of the barbecue. And she's gone, what, there's a Call of Duty on mobile? And next thing you know, we're downloading it. She's playing it at the barbecue. She played at university. She was like the girl in the group, and she was, you know, better than all the guys, and she hadn't played for years because, you know, corporate life caught up. She, you know, had a sensible job. She's a dietitian, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Now every time I log on to Call of Duty Mobile, I can see her in the game. I think, you know, and my other question, sort of where that was going, was whether mobile has given a new lease of life to that kind of gaming culture as well.
Oh, no doubt. Mobile and casual games, I mean, Call of Duty Mobile isn't sort of, I guess, a casual game, but no. Everyone knows, you know, you'd have to have been living under a rock to not know about, you know, the phenomena of Angry Birds and Pokemon Go and all of those sort of games. So it's just a giant segment of gaming. What's interesting, though, is that in sort of hardcore games culture, there's a, you know, there can be some looking down on mobile gaming, you know, and if it's not PC gaming with a pimped out, you know, high spec computer, then it's not real. And I think that what I've learned on the sort of recent journey I've been on, and I say recent, the last couple of years, is just, you know, it's just a bit depressing in some respects about how much hostility or anger or just some bad toxic vibes seem to sort of sit in some of that gaming culture about women, about newcomers to gaming, and, you know, a lot of gatekeeping about who is a gamer, who's not, and who's allowed to do what, who can play what. And it's sort of the one of the core rationales in a way for what we're trying to do with Fortress, which is to provide an antidote for some of that and to provide a home for gamers of all shapes and stripes, and say, you know, if you're a newcomer to gaming and you know you've been a bit intimidated by that online culture, then this is the place for you. We welcome and embrace people who've kind of, we call them, you know, games curious, who've sort of always wanted to learn something about a game but can't fathom it online. And I'll give you a personal example of something. Is I'm a proficient gamer in the sense I've been playing since arcades in the 80s, games, and certainly games like Civilization and strategy games is more my forte. Last month or whatever it is, a couple of weeks, I've been playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare, and I've had years of playing in and out, playing first-person shooter games. But what I noticed playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare, apart from the fact that every time I jump into a multiplayer game, I'm, you know, get a bullet in the head within 6 seconds, not fun. And, you know, we all know that multiplayer games, it can be very challenging for newcomers. Yeah. But what's also difficult with a game like Call of Duty Modern Warfare is if you're not sort of across the tropes and across the mechanism of that game, it's quite impenetrable. So I just don't know how newcomers can get any traction in say the multiplayer environments. And what I also found interesting is when I've been jumping into some of them, and over the last couple of weeks I've been playing a lot, even though I've got my mic rigged up, what's really weird is the dead silence between everybody playing on the phone. You know, all strangers, but people it's very lonely and silent. Yeah. And you're just in there shooting, you're on the blue team trying to like capture, you know, trying to shoot the red team. And yet no one on your blue team talks to you. And I don't talk because I'm as intimidated I'm as much a clueless newbie as anyone alive. So I'm in there just trying to sort of not get killed and not look shit. Yeah. And yet it's just I find it a weird and discombobulating experience in that multiplayer environment. And frankly, I actually prefer to play the campaign. Now, that's just me. I'm not saying that's for everyone, but I wonder how many people share that experience, that it's not as inviting. And what we're trying to get, we'd love a thing where you could come to Fortress and kind of get onboarded into Call of Duty and have someone sit with you and show you how to sort of do it better.
Yeah. Yeah, it boils down. It's funny because it's that 10,000 hours concept that, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talked about, and the fact that, you know, you spend 10,000 hours, eventually become an expert, but it's not quite as simple as that. You need somebody to coach you and give you specific direction within those 10,000 hours, or you don't improve. You know, so it's all well and good you running around a map on, Nuketown in, you know, Call of Duty, but until somebody tells you what you should and shouldn't be doing, you may never improve. But it's really interesting you said that, because I had that exact experience last night. So I'll play Battle Royale in Call of Duty Mobile, and not to brag, but you know, there's a hundred people in it, of which probably, I don't know, 90 of them, 80 of them are bots. You know, but I'm coming first. probably 9 times out of 10. It's actually got to the point where I now try and make it harder for myself by not using certain things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I posted a video. I've also learned how to do screen recordings and edit it down and upload the game to places and YouTube and so on. But I posted a video, a 4-minute video on Reddit, and Reddit's the fucking wild west of the internet anyway. So, you know, you're brave going to Reddit in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
But I posted a 4-minute video of me in a helicopter, realizing I was being followed by another helicopter. And then my 4-minute kind of campaign to try and destroy the other guy's helicopter, which I did, posted the video, get one comment on Reddit. Which is critical of me, of how I've landed the helicopter and how I need to learn to burst fire. And I'm sort of going, wow, do you know what I mean? I'm coming first in every game, and still the single one comment that I get is that I'm not doing it right. So I completely understand how, from a newbie's point of view, that it must be terrifying out there to try and, you know, get take part of these games.
Or if you're a female. A young woman who, I've heard stories that they hear a female voice and then people pounce and start making comments, or, you know, it's just, and even I've noticed a lot of the handles and stuff that people use for their online characters are very, you know, they're almost to a person deliberately provocative or sexist. And it's just what's going on? Now, I'm not here to rant about all of it, but it's just something, I guess what we're trying to say with what we're doing at Fortress is to provide an antidote to some of that.
Before we talk a bit more about the gaming industry, because obviously this is supposed to be a marketing podcast. I want to kind of talk at it from a marketing perspective.
Yeah.
Your background, I think the most interesting thing I think about your background is you've kind of jumped from entertainment industries that themselves have undergone, to a degree, but that they've all undergone some sort of massive upheaval. Yeah. So you're in the music industry first, then you went into the cinema industry, and now you're in the gaming.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the. I know you're outside of the industry now, but I'm really interested to understand that health of the cinema and the movie industry. And whether from a business perspective, there's still opportunities for things like marketing and partnerships with films and sponsoring, you know, cinema advertising. Where's that kind of at the moment?
I probably am not the best candidate to, I'm probably is just more like an observer. I obviously was in that milieu for 5+ years, but I didn't work for the cinema business at Village Roadshow. I was on the sort of, a bit of a jack of all trades around digital marketing, digital development. Yeah. So I had some input and worked with them, but I wasn't in the thick of the cinema business. Yeah. So, I was close to, I was in Village, sort of close to all those industries, theme park, cinema, distribution and all of that. So I think, my observation on cinema is, also informed by my view about movies, and that is that, I struggle to find movies that I personally want to watch because I'm not a fan of big Hollywood franchises. So I don't watch Marvel movies that my kids can't even drag me along with them because I've got no interest in watching movies that are bereft of peril, predictable outcomes, weird and always everything descends into a UFC fight. It's just not for me, right? So I've got a bit of a jaded attitude, and I actually loved reading last week Martin Scorsese wrote a piece for the New York Times about his disillusionment with cinema, and I thought that was marvelous. I love that. Anyway, so I'm always looking for great new movies, like weird one-offs, like Hereditary was a movie that blew my mind. And I like those kind of quirky horror films like The Witch or Hereditary or even Midsommar was awesome, right? So these sort of things, I'm always looking for that. So I've got a bit of a view that it's, when it comes to movie going and where that resides, I like the fact, and it's something that we've built our business at Fortress on, the notion that people, no matter what's going on, always want to go out. And that's a mantra of philosophy at Village Roadshow that I absolutely subscribe to. So cinemas aren't dying, or it's not that you can't write their death knell yet, because even though there's 1,000 streaming services and cheaper options to watch movies at home, people just want to go out and have a social experience. And that's kind of part of the philosophy for us, that you can play, you can have an awesome rig at home and play games in your bedroom or in your lounge room, but you can also go out and have a social experience. So I think that that's the bulwark for that industry against the ultimate disruption of being put out of business, because I think there's this fundamental drive that people have that they need. You know, that you give them a social opportunity to get out of the home and be with other people. That's a powerful force, and I think that's going to defend against, you know, the death of movies in the cinema or whatever. But, you know, movies have to continue. The experience of going to the movies has to adapt and change. And I think what happened with the cinema experience over the last, say, 15 years, 20 years, was they went – and this is not Village Roadshow, this is my opinion or my view, is what happened was – cinemas went down a very cost-cutting, commoditized road, where you were seeing, say, 10 years ago, the development of sort of self-serve cinema, where reduce a multiplex down to 2 staff, almost have a sort of, you know, turnstile to get in. You know, when you go to the movies in the afternoon, you could sit around all afternoon and just jump from cinema to cinema and no one would really know, right? Yeah. But that's because they stripped it down to an absolutely bare bones experience. But what happened was, while they were doing that, cutting costs and trying to make that experience as sort of, seamless for the customer, but also very hands off, people on the other side, you know, people, the needle shifted and people started saying, no, when I go to the cinema, I want a full touch experience. I want, you know, hand dipped chop tops and, you know, popcorn that was made in front of me, and I want ushers to show me to the seat, and I want a full experience. And so I think the cinema business or cinema experience got kind of caught having gone down this cul-de-sac of cost-cutting and minimalist cinema experience, whilst in parallel these rich cinema experiences of this kind of authentic, all-encompassing sort of show, make an evening for me of this, arose on the other side of the fence, and now they're trying to scramble to find, you know, well, let's move to this model now and like do a high touch experience. And so I think they're now in a bit of a, you know, they're moving more resources into that.
And of course, I think, you know, the streaming services and everything created, and it's still creating, you know, panic. There's, you know, HBO and Disney launches, I think, end of this month, Disney Plus. You know, Netflix is just becoming stronger and stronger. Apple's trying their hand at Apple Plus. You know, at the end of the day, from a cinema's perspective, you go, you know, do you go and spend that amount of money sitting in a dark room, spending an insane amount of money on snacks and popcorn and et cetera, et cetera? Or do you wait 8 weeks and sit and watch it at home on a giant screen and on a streaming service? So, you know.
Well, I think that if you can provide the social experience that I mentioned earlier and make it a really rich and engaging experience that actually is bookended, the movie is one thing, the sitting on the seat is one thing in the cinema, but on either end of that experience, if it's made fun and interesting, then I think people will do it. But if it's just a commodity, then if you've got a big screen at home and, you know, a bottle of wine that you've made, you know, pouring yourself, well, of course it's hard to compete. But that's why cinemas now need to, you know, bring more to their experience than just the film.
Yeah. Going back to the gaming industry where you are at the moment, one of the interesting things that I'd heard 2-3 years ago from via my brother, via somebody who worked at Sequoia, one of the biggest VC companies in the world, if not the biggest, and they were talking about the next opportunity in terms of social media and all those kind of things. And one of the big things that all the VC companies were struggling with was to say, you know what, we can put ads in Facebook Messenger, we can put ads in WhatsApp and Instagram and blah, blah, blah. But there's this huge volume of conversations, text conversations, not audio conversations, but there's a huge volume of text conversations happening within games that nobody can access, you know, certainly if advertisers can't access. My question then is if you're a business, if you're a small business or a big business, whatever size of business you are, how do you get involved And let's say you're a business and you recognize that your target market is the gaming industry or the people within the gaming industries. How do you then go out and sort of marketing to these people and building partnerships with you know, either games or places like Fortress? What's the best way of doing that?
Well, I certainly wouldn't advocate interrupting the game's experience with advertising because that's just like, you know, throwing acid in people's eyes when playing a game, and then suddenly, you know, local gym's used car lot comes up as a, you know, like a Google AdWord type effect in your chat stream in Call of Duty. You'd be horrified.
Yeah.
But I think what gamers do dig is relevant connections between their gaming experience and the products to be sold. So it's therefore it's very challenging for non-endemic, say, you know, a bank trying to find customers amongst, you know, Gen Z, millennial types by just sort of, you know, any sort of insertion of an ad is not going to work. So how does a bank do it? I mean, I'd like to obviously say, you could be a partner of Fortress and, you know, and have some sort of connection there, but even then it's challenging because I think what the gamers are looking for, they love things like, you know, the tech is obviously popular, so, you know, the promotion of an awesome new headset or something would feel probably a lot more natural to gamers like that. And whether a tech company then can work with a publisher to make that a virtual good, so that, you know, you could be, your character could get that the virtual Beats, you know, headphones, walk around in the game with them on, and just create that association, right? So I think creating associations that make sense inside a game, for us at Fortress, the way we've approached partners and sponsors is to, you know, talk about real estate in the venue that gives this kind of presence and credibility that says we're connected with this Fortress brand, and, you know, it's sort of an advocation of there's a nexus between Fortress and that brand, so therefore there's something good to be said about both. But we've been careful not to just sort of, sell our wares to anyone and talk to anyone who turns up and say, you can just have a brand on our wall, because that's going to be, you know, a failed thing. Even if someone paid us money for it, we would not want the money, because it's going to end up just biting us in the ass, because the gamers won't dig that.
I also get the feeling that gamers are much more prone to spending money to keep advertising out of their
You know, that's possibly as well a premium versus a free, you know, freemium and premium, and then you just pay to cut it out. I think gamers actually don't mind ads when it's relevant and interesting. I mean, certainly trailers for new games is going to always be appealing to gamers. And I think that technology and brands that are sympathetic to gamers that are, you know, do product sampling or working the trade shows and doing things that sort of connect the dots between the gamer's life and experience and what they are offering. There's hard work involved. So just purchasing ads is not the answer.
And what about the sponsoring of things like teams as well? Because that's kind of another thing that's evolved out of the gaming industry in the last probably 5 years, that there's these professional players that have their teams that go around the world and compete in tournaments. Is that something that you think's perhaps got a little bit more flexibility in terms of the advertising?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look at how effective is it it may well be, but how effective is it when, you know, the McLaren racing team or something in Formula One has, you know, 50 sponsors, or when you watch, I'm back from North Melbourne, and so when you watch the coach, you know, at the end of the game, and they just chuck up the screen behind the coach with, you know, 20 logos of all the different sponsors, and you go, well, how does that resonate with the audience?
Yeah.
But what I would say is that sponsoring of teams is a question around where do you want to position your product, because teams and esports is also a subset of gaming culture. So, you know, there's no doubt hundreds of thousands of people playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare right now that barely would even know that esports exists.
Yeah.
And so if you're out there sponsoring teams, you need to know that your goal, therefore, is that, you know, you're attracting esports fans and esports is a thing. And I think that probably a team sponsorship is a bit like esports is like the haute couture of in clothing. You know, that there's the runway in Milan, and then the designers are out there with, you know, weird and wonderful designs as the models come out, and then 6 months later the unwashed populace are out there wearing a variation of those fashion designs. I think that esports is a bit like that the pro players at the absolute elite level are doing things that then trickle through to the general population later. So maybe there's a strategy there about, you know, like a sort of, we want to position our brand in that elite pro space, and that will then have a bleed down effect. So I think it works very well for the big PC gaming companies, so the Alienwares, the Omens, the MSIs, whatever, where they're, you know, partnering with teams, and then down the track the average player sees that this elite team uses this hardware, so wow, I need to get that as well. Mm. So that's very effective.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, going back to something you said earlier about, you know, have, you know, you've got those gamers that are using the hard, you know, the proper computers, which is what I grew up on. You know, I went to university and we all went out and bought PCs, and then, you know, one of the smart kids came around and plugged Ethernet cables into all of them, and, you know, we had cables hanging out windows and under doors, and, you know, big LAN parties. And then it went to the console, you know, and then it's on the mobile. I think it's funny now, certainly with Call of Duty Mobile, there seems to be a bit more of a more respect for it as a game than perhaps other mobile games might have had in the past.
Yes.
And the amazing thing, I think, with Call of Duty Mobile, because I was a Call of Duty Modern Warfare, Black Ops, blah, blah, I've, you know, played them all until I had kids, and then I had to sell the Xbox, and I never quite recovered from that, John, but, you know. But the thing is, now I can play 5-10 minutes and nobody knows. I don't have to turn a TV on, turn a console on, sit in an armchair. Yeah, do it in my car while I park the car. You know, it's that kind of thing. What again, going off on a tangent here, what really amazes me about Call of Duty Mobile is the computing power involved in running that game in just a mobile phone.
Well, isn't it being streamed? Isn't it the power's happening in the cloud?
Quite possibly. But I, you know, even so, the sheer capacity of the game running on something like that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You still need some. You wouldn't be doing it on an iPhone 4.
No. So anyway, kind of went off on a tangent there. Okay, last few questions for you. You mentioned Civilization, and there's friends of mine in the UK now who used to literally waste their university career playing Civilization because it was a hideously addictive game. But what were your go-to games when you started gaming in those kind of, you know, late teenage years, early 20s? What were you playing all the time back then?
Well, because I was a teenager in the 80s and I lived in the arcade, so the games that I played were Gauntlet with my friends.
And
that would gobble up. You'd just burn 5-10 bucks in, which was then quite a bit of money. Yeah. That would be lost in an hour. So, and devilishly hard games like Ghosts and Goblins, which I could never get through. But the one game which is very obscure that I was actually, you know, feel a bit of pride in that I was a bit of a champ at was a Laserdisc game, a bit like Dragon's Lair, but it was called Super Don Quixote. And you can look it up online and see it. And it was an awesome Laserdisc game. And I actually could finish that game. And because it was a very interesting game for people to spectate, I could play in an arcade that game for, say, finish it in an hour and a half or an hour, whatever, and have like 20, 30 people behind me. So that was kind of fun. And I used to be at university in the early 90s. I used to, I won't say what I was up to. I was, out at 3 a.m. And a mate of mine and myself would get out to those arcades on Lygon Street, and we would get into them at 2 a.m. and hit Twin Cobra. And by the time I finished uni, I don't know what else I was able to do, but I was able to play Twin Cobra on 40 cents for about 3 hours. And then another favourite was Rygar the Legendary Warrior. It was another arcade game that I really loved. And then as I've got older I actually picked up Civilization 1 in the early 90s and became addicted then. So I've been playing every variant of it for the last 25 years. So I'm pretty skilled at Civilization, even though I've never been able to win at sort of deity level, but I'm pretty good. I can get up to sort of immortal and challenge games, challenge the computer there. So And I just play. I like to play lots of games. Baldur's Gate was massive. I played all those Neverwinter Nights, all of those games. It's probably my favourite game of all time in terms of just the one that's had the most profound effect on me. That I just went, this is just, you know, better than even any TV show, any movie. Was The Last of Us Remastered?
Yes.
That is an entity as an entertainment come moral tale of just harrowing whatever. That's probably the peak of gaming experience that I've ever had.
Yeah, I was definitely a Civilization. The joke at my university was just one more turn. You know, we used to leave.
Yeah, sure. I've played thousands of hours of Civ.
I had a friend that we used to leave him, you know, when the bar closed at 11, 12 o'clock at night, we'd all go up there, play for a couple of hours. About 1 o'clock in the morning, we'd all go to bed and leave our friend there and, you know, go back up there at 7 in the morning and found that he hadn't moved. You know, it's standard. You know, that was standard. God knows how we ever got a degree, really. But
people change. Another interesting thing that's changed, a bit like how movies and music are now on tap. And so, you know, we think of music as just like a commodity, a utility on tap. You can just, you want a song, you just say, hey, Siri, play this song, and bang, you play the song, right? I think the change also for when I was a kid and, until relatively recently, but certainly when I was a kid, games were an expensive commodity that you had to save up for and you'd blow money on, right? Yeah. So you burnt your pocket money playing games, and to go in for an afternoon into an arcade, that chewed up dough, you know, that you didn't have a lot of. Yeah. And so now, because games are there so they're ubiquitous and effectively free, I don't know what I'm saying here, but I think it's like music. When I was a kid, you know, to buy an album, you saved up your money and got that one final album, and it took 2 weeks to order in at the local record store.
Yeah.
Those 10 songs were precious to you. Playing Gauntlet for, you know, burning $5 in an hour playing Gauntlet was like a religious experience because it cost you a lot of time and money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's changed so drastically. And I mean, I was back in the Civilization, and then I went into Command and Conquer and played that till I was, you know, blue in the face. And then it was all Call of Duty and more mobile gaming. And I still sort of joke about Clash Royale at the moment and Clash of Clans. And I go, there's some people, I've been on that, playing that game for 6-7 years now, you know, I joke with my wife and I joke with other people. I said, there's some people on that game that I have never met, and I wouldn't recognize them in the street if they walked past me. But some of them, I know the intimate details of their lives.
Yeah.
I know their personalities. I know how they act, and never spoken to them, never, you know, but there's 50 people in this clan, of which 10 or 20 of them I could quite easily describe to you.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah. And that's a different experience to the one that I've grown up with. I think because I grew up in the world where you played the computer and nothing else. To this day, I'm not a multiplayer gamer. I actually find it, for me, not for everyone, I understand why it's really, and I wish I could be different, but I find being in a game with strangers a bit weird.
Yeah.
And I don't gravitate to it. And so a good example is I love playing Hearthstone, but I only ever play the solo adventures. I don't play the tavern brawls or the I when I go online and I've done it a few times, and then I'm playing some stranger overseas and I go, it's kind of weird. Yeah. And I don't know why I think that. It's just probably because I grew up not playing anything but an AI, that I've grown up to sort of find it strange playing strangers, but I see why others love it, and I wish I could. I need to sort of almost re-engineer my thinking and get into it.
Yeah, I mean, I my baptism of fire with gaming was probably a few years after you, so it was very much Doom and Wolfenstein 3D, we were all playing on a LAN at university with the cables hanging out the windows. So it was a hugely social experience. So I guess that's then come forward to my, you know, current, you know, the way that I like. And then I played a lot of World of Warcraft as well. And that you can play on your own, but is also kind of adds another dimension if you start doing dungeon raids and, you know, those kind of things. But look, we're going to have to wind this up because I know you've got places to be. My last question for you, where does it go to from here? You know, you're in the industry now. You're obviously a gamer. where's the industry going in the next 5-10 years? Is virtual reality something that you're looking at? What are we going to see coming up?
Well, I'd like to think we're going to see, a lot more live and social game playing experiences where people get out of the home and meet people and play games, in social live environments like the one we're building, and hope to build more. Mm. So that's, selfishly, but also hopefully that's something that the culture shifts so that I mentioned earlier my teenage years in arcades. We're trying to sort of bring some of that spirit of that back to say, when you play games, how about playing them in a live social environment rather than home? So I'm very keen and, hoping that is rings true, and that we can provide an experience that moves people from, solo gaming, albeit multiplayer online solo gaming, playing it alone, to playing with friends, either casual gaming or, of course, hardcore serious gaming with, down there in a land lounge playing Dota 2. More people, making that more mainstream so that it's not just, as it has always been, land cafes and land lounges have been very sort of specifically a niche. We're trying to break that open and make it more mainstream. So that's one thing. I'm not that bullish about VR. I've got, at home, Sony PSVR, I've got Oculus Rift. But I find all that initial excitement, and I certainly was excited, in the end, when it boils down to, I've got an hour or an hour and a half at night to play games, just the tedium of getting the headset on and then you can't see your cup of tea it's so cumbersome VR I find it just such a pain to play VR games, even though some of them are pretty awesome, like Blood and Honor is a great game, but despite how good it is, I struggle to get motivated to put that headset on because if I've only got an hour, I can just, very quickly jump into something that, doesn't require that effort. So VR needs to get easier. I think there's got to be that AR-VR nexus where you've almost got like a pair of lightweight glasses that can, easily go from a VR where the whole glasses are shielded through to an AR where you can see through them so that you're not like in kind of in this shroud of, lack of perception. So that's something. Mobile gaming is going to continue to be big and I love the idea, and this was a revelation to me only a few weeks ago, and I didn't know. I was like, how good is this? Is the PS4 app that lets you kind of play your PS4 remotely on your phone.
Wow.
So, you download the app, it can connect to your personal PS4 at home, and then you can sort of sit in your office, plonk your tablet or your phone down. You can actually even Bluetooth a controller to your tablet or phone and be playing your PlayStation on your tablet or phone from, 50 Ks away or whatever. And that's cool. And I mean, I sound probably pretty naive and ignorant that I didn't know that existed.
No, I didn't know that existed.
Yeah, well, I got it working in my office the other day going, Jesus, this is awesome. So, more remote ability to sort of, find remote play. I mean, what we also, everyone's keen to see is some of those on-tap streaming services for gaming arrive in Australia that they've had for years in the US, like the PlayStation Network, whatever, so that you can just, you don't need to be, downloading and buying all these games. You can just turn on and bang, you're playing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, look, there's so much going on. I mean, the VR you touch on there, I've done the free roaming VR thing as a social experience with a zombies game, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah. I thought it was still a couple of years behind where it needed to be.
Yeah.
And my question was how often I would go to something like that.
Yeah.
But that's when I thought, well, maybe if my local event cinema got rid of one of their screens and put a free roaming VR experience in there, you might go to it more often.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that they're hard to refresh the game, and so once then you may not want to go for another year or two until they've got a new game. So it's a very much a one-shot kind of entertainment experience, which is not economical for the then it means that the return visitors is hard. So it's always then about managing churn, which is not a great business model.
No, you want people that want to come back every week or every 2 weeks or, every couple of days, like an arcade did, because, that's where kids would go and they'd hang after school. So if you've got something that, that kids can, go to, and I guess this is where Fortress comes in, which is going to be an awesome segue for me to wrapping up here. But this, I guess that's where you've got that opportunity for kids to come after school or at weekends with their mates, that kind of thing. And they can come more than once in once every 6 months.
Oh, indeed. I mean, you could be coming every day. You could come. I mean, it's not limited because we're only limited by the games. And, even if we also try to keep things like the menu refreshed so that, you can make it your home. We call it your home away from home. That's our sort of one of our taglines, is that we're wanting to create an environment that's fun and safe and really speaks to people who love games and games culture. So that when you come, you feel like, this is a great place just to hang out because I love playing games. I love being surrounded by the culture of games. There's good people here. It's good food. That's the environment we're trying to create.
Yeah. Look, I'm super excited. When do you actually open? What's the sort of target date for that?
We're hopefully on target to be opening our doors to the public from Monday, March 2, I think, is the date.
Oh, brilliant. I will be booking my flight to come down and spend a weekend there. Mate, look, thank you very much for being on the show. As I say, I'm a bit of a gamer fanboy. So excited when I saw what you guys were doing there, just because I thought it was, if nothing else, I think it's a fantastic business opportunity. I think that's as a commercial enterprise, it's an absolute no-brainer from my perspective. And it always surprises me why people haven't done it before this. But look, thank you very much.
Hard.
Well, yeah, I can imagine it is. Yeah, it's certainly from a technical point of view as well. Yeah. It's not like a screen and a projector. It's got a bit more to it than that. So
yeah.
But look, thank you very much for being on the show, and wish you luck, and well keep in touch. So thanks very much for everything today.
Oh, good on you, Simon. My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it. One of my favorite podcasts of all time, just because it's a subject matter that's very close to my heart. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got a lot out of it. I hope if you're thinking about investing in marketing and advertising within the gaming industry, it taught you a few things. I would go and connect with John on LinkedIn if you can. Find out more about Fortress Esports. All sorts of stuff happening. But thank you for tuning in, and we will hope to see you next time.